I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. The Trump campaign, hired Breitbart's Stephen Bannon to lead its operation, has been getting advice from former Fox News president Roger Ailes, and Donald Trump himself has been a guest on Sean Hannity's Fox show more than 40 times, fielding friendly questions. There is speculation that Trump could be building a media empire if his White House bid doesn't work out. On the Democratic side, billionaire media mogul Michael Bloomberg, who has toyed with the idea of running for president, has thrown his support behind Hillary Clinton. This has been an unusual campaign season, to say the least, raising questions about coverage, objectivity, punditry, and the sometimes blurry lines between journalism and politics. And we have two guests to talk about all of this in this hour of Radio Times. Joining us from the NPR studios in New York is Sarah Ellison, contributing editor for Vanity Fair. Wrote a book called The War at the Wall Street Journal. And Sarah Ellison, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Jeffrey Bayman. He's chair professor of media studies and production at Temple University. He wrote a book called From Cronkite to Colbert, The Evolution of Broadcast News. And Jeff Bayman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you, Marty. Pleasure to be here.
Nice to have you both here. And where to begin? Well, let's begin with Donald Trump. And let me start with you, Jeff. Did the news media help to launch Donald Trump's campaign and also help him win the Republican primary?
Oh, I don't think there's any doubt whatsoever in that crowded field of 16. He was the ratings draw. He was the great show, and pretty much everybody, particularly in the TV business, knew if they put him on air, they got the ratings, and so they followed that. One estimate puts it at he got as much as $2 billion in free media as opposed to having to spend a dime on advertising.
And to you, Sarah, was he just the master manipulator of the media?
Well, I think that the way that he started out in the campaign was much more complicated. People were, I mean, the media beat itself up for a little while for ignoring him through last summer. The Huffington Post decided to cover Trump in its entertainment section, not in its news section. So the news media felt very disdainful of Trump in, as a general principle, I think. And, I mean, what was fascinating to me was to watch how he continued to, yes, get $2 billion in free airtime, but that was largely because he simply managed to be a better entertainer. And I feel like that's where the lines really have started to blur. What we're talking about media, we're talking about politics, but what Trump really is an entertainer.
Well, was it also his availability, the fact that he was so, unlike Hillary Clinton, so friendly to so much of the press, Sarah?
Well, he was. He did a lot of calling into news programs. He did a lot of commenting on things. He was very unguarded. He felt very available. Certainly, the news media responded to that. I mean, they definitely were used and happy. I mean, a lot of political reporters joke about, you know, just use me, give me your access and talk to me. And it's not just about Trump. It's about pretty much any politician who's running. But Trump was also an incredibly he was really good on media. He would say outrageous things. He would say, things that were jaw-dropping. I mean, we start out the campaign talking about how Mexicans are rapists and how John McCain isn't a war hero. And I think that the media didn't really know what to do with him. I mean, if you're schooled in sort of traditional notions of journalistic objectivity, you kind of quote someone, then you look for someone that sort of supports some kind of an analysis that you're making. You look at somebody from the other side, but you present things in a pretty dispassionate way. And I know a lot of people that I was talking to, a lot of my colleagues in the kind of political arena, political journalists, would think we're going to cover the comments from Trump and just put them out there because they're so wild in some ways. You know, again, like the Mexicans are rapists and John McCain isn't a war hero, that they'll speak for themselves. And instead of that, I mean, they did speak for themselves. And in fact, people really responded to it. And it ended up being a kind of very heavy Trump show.
Well, let me go back to you, Jeff, and talking. This was the Shorenstein Center, I think, did the analysis coming up with something like $2 billion worth of free media. Does that mean the coverage wasn't critical, or is Sarah saying that this was a candidate that the media, the press, interviewers did not know how to deal with?
I think they didn't know how to deal with. I think they relied on familiar forms. They assumed, I think perhaps correctly, that he is an entertainment figure. They didn't take him seriously as a political force. And that might have been the real misreading here, was to think that entertainment and politics or news and comedy are necessarily distinct. Because I think, if anything, in this moment we live in this profound age of blurred boundaries, to where a serious political force can come from entertainment or vice versa. One can move from politics into entertainment quite easily. So those boundaries are always in flux right now.
And is it because this is new and shiny and unusual and controversial that has all those kinds of features?
Well, and a lot of the news media are, quite frankly, ratings driven. You know, they're in the entertainment profit business just as much as the primetime programming. So I think they saw a very lucrative commodity. They also assumed that he was going to fizzle and that we were going to get over it. We could cover him and laugh about him for a few months, and then he would go away and we'd get back to serious business. And that might be really what took people by surprise, is that instead of fading, he just seemed to get more and more resonant.
And Sarah, one way to drive an audience's away is to talk about policy, to talk about infrastructure or something like that. But when you look at a lot of the coverage, even to this day, and I have the TV on right behind Jeff's head here, a lot of it is horse race coverage, which is who is up and who is down and who is falling and who's on whose side, rather than the kind of deeper policy debates. And I don't know whether that's what people want or not, or whether that's something that journalists even are interested in doing.
Well, I think that that's a great point and a key distinction. I mean, that's not a new thing in political coverage, right? We've always – this is a conversation that people who are interested in the policy debates always have in every presidential election. This year is perhaps – the most sort of the year that we've got the most to complain about, possibly. But the interesting distinction between the kind of coverage that Trump gets and the kind of coverage that Hillary gets, it's not necessarily that one is positive or negative. I think it's that she really is trying to make these policy points and certainly wants to win. But she's attempting to engage in these issues with Trump, who to me, it seems like he's making points, but he's making points that are much more geared to the media, for media consumption. These are one-liners. These are slogans that are so effective and that are so easily transmitted on whether it's television news or on the radio when he calls in, or you know, he's able to manipulate that particularly well. And Hillary, she isn't. She's trying to make a specific point about a policy issue or answer something very specifically. And the final thing I'll say on this is that what I've been struck by is how much she is seen as not telling the truth about things. She's seen as dishonest. You know, voters view her as not being particularly honest. And that's because I think she's parsing questions and trying to kind of really be specific in her answers. Whereas Trump, when you fact check him, he sounds like he's telling you the truth, but he actually is just spewing out statistics that have no basis in reality. And one sounds really honest and the other one sounds dishonest, but it's because she's sort of trying to hew to some kind of specificity in her numbers, and he doesn't seem to be bound up in that as much.
In fact, picking up on that, Jeff, all the fact checking organizations, you know, put Donald Trump up here in terms of pants on fire and not telling the truth, and Hillary down as one of the more truthful campaigners within, I guess, the criteria of someone running for president. But it is interesting that there's this disconnect, and yet for the public, they see them as equally untruthful, probably for different reasons.
Well, I think we need to take a long view here, because neither of these people just came on the scene a few years ago. We're not learning who they are right now. These are both very well-known, to use a phrase, brands. Hillary, of course, has been in the public eye for decades and has had a very coordinated onslaught. I mean, she is the one that coined the phrase the vast right-wing conspiracy. She has been dealing with this, you know, Whitewater, Vince Foster. This has been going on for years, that there has been this effort to sort of assassinate her character. I don't like using that word, but right. I think there has been an attack on her integrity that has just taken root and become a fact of the political arena, regardless of its factuality or lack thereof. Trump, on the other hand, you know, he spent 11 years on NBC on The Apprentice honing his reality TV profile. He's a brand. He is literally a brand around the world. His name rings out, and he has crafted an image going back to the mid-'80s of being a particular thing, that swaggering, wealthy, straight shooter that he is taken as being. So I think that when we look at trying to fact check what he said today or what Hillary said yesterday, that has to be taken in the context of decades, really, of media relations.
Well, there is this whole question about objectivity, Sarah, and I'm reading an email from Todd from Vineland. He says, I find most stations and news agencies have a slant for one candidate. CNN and WHYY are pro-Clinton, where usually the leading or secondary story is negative Trump. And it does raise questions, I think, about for anyone that's in this business, which is, had you cover someone like this? And I wonder how you wrestle with that.
Well, I think that the question of media objectivity is obviously been a hot one for a while. And I think that there people inevitably do bring some level of bias to their coverage. And traditional journalists were taught to sort of try to forget those as much as possible, forget those biases, and cover someone very fairly. I think that what's happening now is that a lot of the more conservative pundits and conservative journalists have been talking about how, with their audience, if they're trying to fact check a point, and I'm sure this is true also on the left to a degree, mm-hmm. that you can't, there's no source that anyone believes to fact check it. So if you are talking to a certain audience, you say, well, the New York Times looked into this claim and they found that this was incorrect. Well, the response to that is, well, that's just the New York Times. It's, you know, everyone is sort of steeped in their own
realities.
I think that it's becoming much more the whole question of objectivity relies on an ability to kind of come down to some truth on the matter, and we accept this notion of bias, right, that it exists, and people try to not, you know, in traditional journalism circles, you try to not have much bias in your coverage, but it's sort of inevitable. But the problem is that there's no original source to go to. Do you mean what it becomes a very circular argument at a certain point?
Jeff, you want to add to that about a minute before our first break here?
Yeah, I think the notion of objectivity assumes a certain rationality and an interest in neutral argument on the behalf of the ordinary person. I'm not sure it's accurate to say that ordinary people – I mean, I think most people, quite frankly, are really paying attention to political media in order to learn the facts to then come to a decision. I think that's a mischaracterization of how most people relate to the political process. I mean, I think most people know which side they're on. They know which team they root for. And a lot of this is like watching your team play in, you know, the Phillies game. You know who you're rooting for, and you're watching to see, can I cheer or do I have to be sad? As opposed to, I'm going to make a decision that I haven't actually considered before.
And sort of gravitating towards news outlets that, I guess, reinforce the decision that you've already made.
Oh, I don't think there's any doubt. We take pleasure in our information consumption, so we tend to gravitate towards the information that makes us feel better than the information that does not.
That's Jeffrey Baim. He's chair and professor of media studies and production at Temple University here in Philadelphia. Sarah Ellison joining us from the NPR studios in New York, and she's a contributing editor for Vanity Fair. And we're talking about the media coverage of this presidential race, the blurring lines between journalism and politics. I want to talk more about that. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Jeffrey Baim and Sarah Ellison about covering this unusual presidential campaign season, talking about things like coverage and objectivity. We'll be talking about punditry and more about this blurry line between journalism and politics. Let me read an email from Mike from Wilmington. He says, Trump outright lied to West Virginia miners and they loved him. She told the unvarnished truth and was vilified. He doesn't tell it like it is. He tells calls it like supporters want it to be. You want to speak to that, Jeffrey?
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt for that. I think Trump is honing his product, and it is constructed to resonate with a particular market. And I don't think it has much to do with policy or argument or fact. It has to do much more with affect, with feeling, with, you know, he said in the convention, he said, "I am your voice." And I think that was a very powerful moment where he was saying, this isn't about what ideas I have and whether I have good policy prescriptions. It's about what kind of a person am I, and can you see yourself in me? And for folks who see him as representing a particular identity or constellation of identities, I think he's resonating quite clearly. And for a lot of people who don't see themselves in him, they're really struggling to make sense of it all.
And Sarah, to get into the a bit of the weeds of what she said in West Virginia, was she said the line that got repeated about minors, in a sense, not having this job anymore. But the next sentence was, and we're going to develop solar panels and things like that to take the place of the jobs that you might be losing. And it's just – it's all that subtlety seems to get lost in the discussion.
Well, right. I mean, I think this is exactly – Jeff's point is precisely right, which is that if you want to talk to someone whose livelihood is – becoming somewhat obsolete, and they're going to need to learn new skills to compete in an economy that's changing, that's a difficult thing, and those are tough questions and tough issues for people to wrap their minds around. And I think that that's not as easy as saying we should bring back the job that you had. I mean, what's funny about Trump is that the people that I have spoken to in my home state is Pennsylvania, where they actually do want to be when their jobs are being lost, they want retraining. They want things to be different, and so his message doesn't always resonate. But I do think that it's a when Hillary, you know, for better or for worse, when she gets into the policy issues that she knows so well, it doesn't play well.
Yeah, you want to add something, Jeff? Go ahead.
I do, and I think we really want to think Trump's preferred medium is Twitter, 140 characters. And if you actually look at how he talks, he doesn't engage in paragraph-long or essay-long thoughts as Hillary Clinton does. He engages in very short words. And Hillary Clinton said, are miners going to lose their job? Yes, and we're going to do everything we can. Well, it's very easy just to edit out, are miners going to lose their jobs? Yes, and then play that over and over and over again. So there are really different levels of discourse going on here. The short snippet versus a complicated idea.
Let me quote something from Jim Rutenberg. He's media critic for the New York Times, and he said pretty recently, if you're a working journalist and you believe that Donald J. Trump is a demagogue playing to the nation's worst racist and nationalist tendencies, that he cozies up to anti-American dictators, and that he would be dangerous with control of the United States nuclear codes, how the heck are you supposed to cover him? Jeff, you are training the journalists of the future. What do you say to that?
Yeah, I think it's a very tricky issue figuring out, do the rules of objectivity apply? Because the rules of objectivity assume, if you imagine an umpire in a baseball game, that the players on the field are playing a certain game, the same game. Whereas here, Hillary Clinton is a very traditional political candidate. Donald Trump is a political candidate unlike just about anything we've seen on the national level. And he's not doing politics or campaigning the way that the unwritten rules of the game suggest it should be done. So if journalists are the umpire of that game, and one team isn't even playing the same game, how do you rule on that? How do you weigh in?
And you've got another candidate, Sarah, who has a very difficult relationship with the press. I was looking for the right. I was going to say stormy, but I don't think that's correct. But is almost averse to talking to the media. Hasn't had a press conference in hundreds of days. What do you make of how she's dealing with the press?
Well, I mean, this is where Hillary and Donald Trump are so very different. She has had this long, long history of being attacked. Goes back to before Bill was even governor of Arkansas. And I think she has – you would never hear her campaign say, let Hillary be Hillary, which is sort of the line that Corey Lewandowski, who was the former campaign manager for Donald Trump, used for Trump. And I think that it – she has a relationship with the media that I think is very, very tense and strained. And I think that some people who are, I mean, I wrote about her last summer, and whenever you talk to anyone around Hillary, they say, if only everybody could know her the way I know her. She's so warm and wonderful when you get close to her. And yet, for whatever reason, the apparatus that's built around her doesn't allow that to happen. I think that they're in such a defensive crouch because she has been attacked so much for so many years that they just don't let that person out.
And yet, I mean, this is a very public job, Jeff. I mean,
right.
Running for president, and then if she happens to become president, she's going to have to deal with the press.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And I think it's so interesting, just personal attributes. You compare her to her husband, who was so media savvy and so warm and so charismatic. It could fill the room and had people eating out of his hand. She has a fundamentally different skill set. It's a skill set that is very, very calibrated for policy and figuring out solutions to problems. It's far less calibrated for standing in front of the nation and sort of being, what did somebody say, the emoter in chief. Mm-hmm. You're not commander in chief, but emoter in chief. I feel what you feel. So George Bush, after September 11th, he felt the right things on camera, and people thought that really resonated. So will she be able to do that? Her fine speech at the convention was really one of the first times we've seen her in a format on national television for a half hour or an hour where the focus is entirely on her.
So we want a therapist to be our president? Is that
at
what
times,
we want?
At times, undoubtedly.
Our emoter-in-chief?
Yeah, in moments of tragedy or fear, I think we very much look to our president not just to be the decider, to use another phrase from recent history, but to be the one who can most represent how we feel. And certainly, Trump is doing a fine job of that for a particular subset of the population.
Well, he's also doing that in a way that is really conducive. We've talked about Twitter, but the kind of rage bursts, Twitter is the medium for that. So
Absolutely.
If you have an idea that you want to be – I mean, there is a lot of anger that people express on Twitter, and that's a perfect place for him to really do that, and that's why he kind of thrives in that medium. I wanted to go back to one thing that when you were talking about what Jim Rutenberg had said that
yes.
about journalists being the referees, and I think that that's – to me – being somebody who sort of watches media, that seems like where the business realities of journalism meet this particular moment, where the pressure that we talked about earlier, the kind of the existential pressure that newsrooms are under, whether it's for television ratings or, you know, newspapers who are losing all their advertising, their traditional print advertising revenues. Trump comes at a time, and this election happens at a time, where journalists really aren't nearly as much of a referee as they used to be. They don't have that position because they've sort of been disintermediated, right? You could go right on Twitter and have your message. Politicians use social media themselves, politicians and everybody else does
sure.
that. So I think that, you know, the there used to be a kind of revolving door where if you ran for president as a Republican candidate and you didn't win, you would go and be a contributor on Fox News. And that was a really lovely thing for Sarah Palin, Mike Huckabee. And you've had a lot of John Kasich got his start, not his exact start, but after he was a politician for a little while, he hosted a show on Fox. What Trump has talked about doing, and I wrote about this in June, is that he's actually explored launching his own news network of some kind, whether it's an over-the-top news platform or whether it's something on television. He's sort of is seizing this modern media moment and trying to talk about and thinking about, definitely not, and this is not speculation. I know there's been a lot of speculation. Of course, it makes sense because Steve Bannon has been named his CEO. Roger Ailes, the former CEO and chairman of Fox News, is advising him on debates. But Trump has actually sat and talked to people about, we have this audience and we've identified something that no one has identified, not Fox News, not any other journalists, not any of the people who are sort of in charge of, not the Republican Party, for that matter. And we can, why shouldn't we monetize that? Everybody else is making money off of yeah. our ratings. I mean, to me, that's this sort of perfect moment, whether you think it's dystopian or not, for right now.
You want to add something, Jeff? And let me reintroduce you, and I also want to get some other folks in on the conversation.
Yeah, I think this speaks to the fundamental fragmentation of the news media landscape. So we still think of journalists doing, you know, journalists as being a group who are all operating on the same script. And the reality of our current media environment is we have lots and lots of people who call themselves journalists or who don't call themselves journalists or who play a journalist on TV but not on Twitter. And so within that environment, back to the concept of the umpire on the field, it's not just one umpire. There are all sorts of people, and they're all calling the balls and strikes differently as they want them to be. Within that landscape, it would make perfect sense for somebody who has the marketing appeal of Trump for a particular audience to weigh in and create his own platform to be out there, if it's not 24/7, certainly on a regular basis.
I mean, it sounds like you're both saying the time is right, and if this White House thing doesn't work out, Trump would be almost ideal for this.
Yeah, and it's the next step in a trajectory that if you really look at his history going all the way back to Art of the Deal in 1987, 11 years on The Apprentice, the driving the birther questions after the election of Obama, primarily mm-hmm. on Fox News. He has moved from one media platform to another and has been developing this for decades now.
That's Jeffrey Baim, chair and professor of media studies and production at Temple University, wrote a book called From Cronkite to Colbert, The Evolution of Broadcast News. Sarah Ellison, joining us from New York, contributing editor for Vanity Fair, wrote a book called The War at the Wall Street Journal. And we're talking about journalism covering the presidential race. And again, you can join the conversation. Call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Dale from Lindenberg to join us. Hi, Dale. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, thanks so much. Sure. Love the show.
Thank you.
But I want to say that this show is really exhibit A with what's a major problem, and the referee idea fits perfectly into it. You guys meaning NPR, really making sure there is only two sides. So the referee can be a good analogy, but there's four major candidates that are on the ballot, and we just never hear about them. And even before Secretary Clinton was nominated, you just rarely heard about Bernie. So you guys are part of the problem with what you're not covering.
Well, Dale, I appreciate the call. I would quibble with you. I think there are two major candidates and two minor candidates who are running for office. We when the fall rolls around, we will invite Jill Stein and Gary Johnson to be our guests on Radio Times to make sure that they get some airtime. But this is the struggle, and I've certainly heard this criticism before. Sarah, anything you want to add to that?
Well, I do think that this is the election where there's been an enormous amount of dissatisfaction with both of the mainstream sort of establishment parties. And you saw that Bernie Sanders was certainly a voice that was that I thought was, you know, that not I thought, but it was clearly very resonant for a lot of people. And what he was doing was sort of criticizing the establishment. And Trump is also criticizing the establishment. And I think that, you know, the dissatisfaction in general with two political parties extends to all kinds of establishment ideas and fixed structures. So I think your caller is kind of part of the moment, in fact.
Well, and not to get too defensive here on the radio, but I would say while we may not have covered candidates, we cover a lot of these issues that are I would argue out of the mainstream. Jeff, let me read something, and this is something that Sean Hannity said, and since you teach at Temple University in the media journalism department, Hannity said, I'm not hiding the fact that I want Donald Trump to be the next president of the United States. After all, he says, I never claimed to be a journalist. This is a quote from the New York Times. I don't even know what a journalist is anymore is what I'm asking.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it. You know, the Fox primetime lineup, Fox has always made the point, or I mean, they've tried to make the point that their primetime people aren't journalists. They are opinion and pundits, and that during the day they do journalism, except in the morning on Fox and Friends when that's also punditry and opinion. And that's just a nice illustration of how these lines blur. And I think we live in a moment where the lines between news and entertainment, between politics and comedy, between advocacy and information and marketing and merchandising have become so fundamentally blurred that any one show, any one person might be doing some of it and not others, and carrying out some agendas. One question being how transparent they are. It's nice to hear Sean Hannity come out and say, hey, I'm not objective. I'm trying to achieve an outcome. That's one configuration in this contemporary moment.
Sarah, even picking up what you said earlier in the article that you had in Vanity Fair about the idea of Trump news, do you think the problems at Fox are opening the door to a potential Trump news?
I certainly think that Fox is it's dominant. There's no question in the cable news network. But there is this sense that Fox is the demographic of people who watch it, as with most of the people who watch television news, is much older. There are openings for a younger sort of audience. I don't know if Trump would necessarily appeal to those people, but what's happening all over the news landscape is that it is fragmenting. There is more of an opening than there was 20 years ago when Fox started. And certainly with someone like Roger Ailes, who was such a force and made it such a successful network, not there anymore, I think there is a bit of an opening for an upstart to come in and kind of try to take over a bit of the conservative conversation. But it would never be a voice as dominant. I mean, there isn't going to be that kind of a presence in this kind of media age.
Is that just because Fox is so dominant that it has basically won the cable wars for so many years?
I think it's because that we're going to see we just have so many more voices that can break through. And yes, Fox is dominant, but it's just the way that people aren't watching cable television nearly as much anymore. Okay. There, you know, a lot of a lot of younger people are getting their news through Snapchat and other kind of social platforms. So I think the way that people get the news is entirely different. And it's much more fragmented.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And we don't – Fox is going through a moment of major transformation, not just with the fall of Roger Ailes, but also Rupert Murdoch handing control over to his sons. And they don't have necessarily the same political standpoint of the father. Roger Ailes, you know, it was his personal vision, and he had been making this case for a conservative news channel since the age of Nixon. That he was able to implement his vision and given the resources he needed to do it. And he was incredibly successful, obviously, but clearly for a whole lot of reasons, the fragmentation of the environment, people turning away from television as a primary source of information, the aging of the audience is a real factor. And I think the folks at News Corporation, which owns Fox, are thinking very carefully, trying to decide, what do we do with this thing?
Right. I mean, I think
very quickly, Sarah, because we're almost up on a break. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that certainly James Murdoch specifically was looking at the audience at Fox and the aging of that audience. And one of the things that Roger Ailes always said to people on air was that you have to believe the material because otherwise you'll lose the audience. So he was very stringent with his anchors that they had to sort of really believe what they were saying. And I think that's what's causing inside that newsroom a lot of anxiety about whether or not James and Lachlan Murdoch, who are the sons of Rupert Murdoch, really believe the material on Fox and whether they'll support it in the way that their father has.
Interesting. Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Sarah Ellison and Jeffrey Baim. And again, you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And again, talking about the coverage of the presidential campaign, objectivity, punditry, and we've been talking about this blurry line between journalism and politics. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain, again talking with Sarah Ellison and Jeffrey Baim. Let me get, looks like William from Burlington City, New Jersey, to join us. Hi, William. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay. Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome.
It's a real pleasure. No, I just wanted to make a general comment that, and I'm a young baby boomer, the American, in my social circles, the people I talk to, I get the vibe the American public is far more closely following this race than any time in my lifetime. And I'm sure it has to do with social media and what an unusual race it is. But I just wondered if you had any general comments on that.
Well, that's interesting, William. I appreciate the call. Sarah, does that resonate with you?
I mean, I think that the idea that it has been such an entertaining election and the stakes seem so high because the candidates are so very different would support the notion that people are really tuning into this. And I think that you have, in some ways, Trump to thank for that. And that is exactly the kind of audience that he's talking about. So I do think that sounds right to me.
Let me read an email from Sally. She says, on Meet the Press on Sunday, Chuck Todd said, we are in a post-truth era. Very scary. Jeff, you want to take that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the question of truth and fact and objectivity have been in play for quite a while. It's actually been over a decade now since Stephen Colbert coined the phrase truthiness, which is often misunderstood. But what he meant by truthiness were those comments that are not factual and true but sound good because they fit with what you want to believe. And, you know, he recently tried to update that with the concept of Trumpiness, where it doesn't even need to sound true. It just has to feel good. And because there are so many information sources, you know, one of the favorite expressions. Now, do the research, which means go online and find out whatever it is you're looking for, because you can. You go online, you can find anything stated as a fact that you possibly want. And I know you've been talking about the alt-right. That's a place where they've thrived, you know, being able to go online and, quote-unquote, do the research, find the facts that are not facts, but that make the worldview that you're looking for seem tangible. That, I think, is probably the dominant sort of epistemological standpoint of our era.
I mean, that's the loop you can live in, right?
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And people more and more do. We are increasingly segregated into ideological communities in our neighborhoods, our jobs. We rarely cross that boundary, social media especially.
Let me get.
I think
no,
I just
go ahead, Sarah.
One quick thing, just go, and it sort of goes back to the comment that Sean Hannity says. I never pretended I was a journalist, or I never said I was a journalist. Of course, he's a journalist. He's an opinion journalist and a commentator. But being a journalist used to you, and you have both. You have the opinion pages in all every newspaper. You have, you know, editorials and opinion writers and columnists, and then you have the news pages. What he meant to say was that I wasn't a news reporter. What he's actually saying now is that I don't even need to be tied to these facts that people are kind of banging on about. And I think that's the distinction that is, of course he's a journalist. He might not be, he's a journalist who's a commentator, but there used to be a set of facts that journalists would deal with, and they would disagree on how to interpret them. They would disagree on some of the statistics, but they would be able to have a conversation about it. And I think that that's the sort of post-truth era now is what we've just been talking about, is that doesn't really exist anymore.
I mean, Jeff, was there a good old days of journalism?
Maybe very briefly. I think the idea that this sort of concept we have of objective journalism, it was a very brief moment historically, really. I mean, some people would date it from about 1946 to 2000. You know, truly the end of World War II to the start of Fox News might have been that window, Walter Cronkite and the heyday of the New York Times. And right. whether they were getting at something universal and true and right, or whether that was a particular cultural configuration that fit the moment. You know, the world is very, very different now. And a lot of the claims to authority, the people we used to trust, you know, Uncle Walter, the anchor on the nightly news, that notion of the older white man in the suit with the deep voice who he used to finish his newscast every day. And this is a remarkable statement. He used to say every day, that's the way it is.
Yes, he did.
And if you compare that to a moment now where the common sense reaction to that is, yes, says you. So we have a distrust of anyone who would tell us the way it is, unless it's the way that I personally would like it to be, in which case I'll listen to you.
But at one point, he turned against the war, and he was very public about that.
Yeah, and I think that's a
this
moment where
Cronkite.
He still thought that that was the way it was. That, you know, what do you do if the war truly seems to be a mistake? Do you still pretend, well, one side versus the other? I mean, that's the definition of objectivity has shifted, right? From being this is what we can determine is, you know, the best available version of the truth is something a journalism textbook says you should strive for, versus one side versus the other. Once he said, she said. So we report what the Democrats say, we report what the Republicans say, and then we wipe our hands of it. Versus is it our job in the media to, or journalists to, find the truth of the situation?
Yeah. Sarah, you want to jump in on that?
Well, I do think that, I mean, the definition of objectivity has certainly been, if you quote a Democrat, you have to quote a Republican, and that's just totally unhelpful to readers, and or viewers, anyone who's actually interested in getting to the bottom of something, because then people are just scoring political points versus actually trying to discuss what's actually happening.
Let me see what Mike from Newtown has to say. Mike, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi there.
I sort of see the problem as less an issue of a decline in journalism, journalistic integrity, or the decline of journalism as a profession, and more as a general decline and lack of seriousness among the American people, the American electorate. You know, they're prepared to accept, you know, nonsense stuff as opposed to serious stuff, and that's probably why Hillary Clinton struggles when it comes time to connect with people, and Donald Trump doesn't. I'm old enough to remember Jimmy Carter's Malaise speech, and if you look at it now, it's a grown-up discussion of the problems that we're facing in the United States post-energy crisis and a prescription for how to address that. And had anybody paid attention and had reacted on that stuff as a society, we'd be in much better shape today. But instead, we chose to, you know, look toward a city on a hill or something with Ronald Reagan, et cetera.
Well, so it's interesting,
that's
Mike.
I had to say.
No, I'm glad you did. I'm glad you called into the show. Sarah, you want to respond to Mike's comment?
Sure. I mean, I guess the question is, do we get the media we deserve? And I think that the appetite of what plays in terms of what the ratings are and is certainly a reflection of what the American people kind of want. But I actually think that it's the economic reality of these news organizations. And what Jeff was referring to earlier is like this period of time when newspapers could be a monopoly and sort of say and do and deliver the news from high on the mountain, didn't have to worry about the business realities. Whenever news has been tied to kind of an audience and making money off that audience, it tries to be much more of an entertainment product. And so I think that that's I think probably both the American people and the media are culpable in terms of going the easy way out. And I think that it used to be easier for politicians like Jimmy Carter to deliver maybe a slightly less entertaining speech because there wasn't as much competing for Americans' attention.
Although he was a one-term president, but go ahead, Jeff.
I think that's a key point, and I don't know if the American people are less serious now as much as there are 330 plus million American people, and we are as diverse as we are numerous. And now there is an information source, not for every individual, but for every sort of taste culture, for every ideological standpoint. So we are so past the age of the monopoly, and the basic economics mean that there's a multiplicity of information sources that are each targeting very specific markets. You know, the data that is generated now about every individual and every sort of habitus and taste group is so finely honed that there is an information source for all sorts of people saying all sorts of things, as opposed to the nightly news that everybody watches and now we know what happened that day. Rather, we can pick the one that fits our sense of ourselves.
So whether we're buying a specialized water bottle or voting for president, we want something very specific.
Yeah, that's right. And if we are a serious person, we can find serious news sources, perhaps like this one, where people really engage in thoughtful discussion. And if we're not serious people who just want to have fun with it, we can find a news source that's going to give it to us in that way.
Oh, we're having fun, aren't we?
We are.
Mike, thanks for calling into Radio Times. And you can call as well. We don't want to be the spinach part of journalism. 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Sarah, let me take a little bit of a left turn here. The debates are coming up. There's one scheduled, at least so far, for the end of September. And I know there's a lot of tune-in factor for that. And of course, the candidates are on display. But so, too, are the journalists who'll be asking the questions or whoever's moderating the debates. What do you think the challenge is for a journalist under those circumstances?
Well, you only have to look back at sort of the early Republican presidential debate where Megyn Kelly of Fox News asked Donald Trump a question about his view of women, and she became sort of a main character in his political rise, in fact. And so I think that the journalists who are going to be moderating these debates in the fall, they're trying to make names for themselves. They're trying to be their own brands too. But they're going to be dealing with totally different candidates. And the fact-checking that they have to do on the spot, which has always been the case in every presidential debate, is going to be even more difficult where you have this complete disagreement about what the facts even are. So I think that it's going to be a challenge. And Hillary and Donald Trump couldn't be more different in terms of debaters. So I think that it's going to be they will need to actually be referees. On that one moment, they will need to act as the referee.
Jeff, I I believe it was on CNN, I saw a crawl, and there was something that Donald Trump said, and they had it in the crawl, and then they had in parentheses, not true. I mean, it's hard to imagine doing that in real time, but if you could, it seems to me, for any candidate, that would really be a public service.
Right, right, and that gets back to this concept of objectivity as truth versus objectivity as both sides. I think the debates are going to be so fast-moving, and they're going to be fundamentally unpredictable because we just don't know how either of the candidates are going to perform. And it is a performance, and Sarah's point is right. The journalists are performing as well. So again, this gets back to what is the goal? What are the individual agendas here, and how do they fit within the format? I think it's going to be quite interesting to watch, and we'll have to see
Absolutely.
How it plays out.
Also, this is something that NPR did recently. It got rid of its comments section. They found that it was used by 0.06% of commenters, or I guess of people that went to the site that were the ones that left the messages. And I wonder, since we've been talking a bit about the role of social media, Sarah, what you make of that? And I mean, the idea is that journalists are supposed to mix it up with their listeners or their viewers or their readers. Does this mm-hmm. shut the door on that, do you think?
Well, it literally does shut the door on that. I mean, I think that it could be something about the audience. Maybe they're not that interested in that kind of give and take. Certainly, their comment sections have always been a little bit of a cesspool of journalism. It does – not of journalism, but you have a product and people are angry and they make other comments that might not have much to do with the actual content of a piece. I think that journalists and sort of news organizations are trying to figure out what this means to try to involve the audience. And that's where I mentioned Snapchat earlier, where the kind of being able to share an article that you agree with and comment on it on your own platform seems to be a much more popular thing to do than actually going into somebody else's universe, which is NPR's website, and making a comment there.
Yeah. Any thoughts on that, Jeff?
Yeah. I mean, one of the great questions here is civic behavior, and what does it mean to be politically engaged, not on the part of the media, but on the part of the public and individuals? So how do you talk about politics with your family, with your friends, with strangers when you're putting a little comment on a long stream on a website? And it is a real challenge for the folks who are designing social media platforms. They're thinking a lot about how do we There have to be rules. There have to be rules to have some kind to ensure some – to say some comments are not acceptable and others are, and we want these kinds of comments and not those. And so everybody's struggling with what's the infrastructure, the technology that can be put in place, or the code of ethics for a website to produce the kind of ideal civic dialogue that we all want to believe will help us come up with good solutions to our problems.
Let me see if I can squeeze one more caller on. Lisa from Wayne. Lisa, we're almost out of time, but go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, thank you very much. First, great, great show, great
thank
topic.
You. Thank you.
I just don't know that I necessarily think that there was this sort of objectivity in journalism that went right to 2000 and Fox News. I don't disagree with the effort or the inclination towards trying to be objective. But in my mind, I go back to the 1900s, the Theodore Roosevelt era, which is very well known for his engagement with reporters almost on a one-on-one basis, where he would review his thoughts, his policies, before presenting them to the world, either in speeches or otherwise. And I'm not sure that objectivity in its purest form could ever exist. What is lacking now, and it goes to the points you're just making
sure.
at the moment with everyone in a keyboard and a smartphone, that there's not a level of discernmentship or an ability to edit or to evaluate or to have someone go back for deeper analysis. And I think in the immediacy, you have the opportunity to create stories that just lack in merit and are picked up by the mainstream. I won't even begin to get into my thinking.
In fact, don't begin to do any of that, Lisa, because we're just about out of time. But I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Jeff, I saw you slowly, quietly nodding your head there as she was talking.
Yeah, well, I think that the question is people's aptitude for critical thinking, because these are critical, serious issues we're dealing with. And this is a question of education, of socialization, of political training, of political engagement. I don't have any answers on that one, but to say that, you know, media literacy is another thing we think a lot about. Are people sophisticated in assessing the sources of information and themselves being able to tease out, yeah, that sounds good, but that can't be right, versus I'll buy it hook, line, and sinker.
We're going to end on that note. My thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Time. Sarah Ellison, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And she joined us from the NPR studios in New York. A contributing editor for Vanity Fair wrote a book called The War at the Wall Street Journal. Jeffrey Baim, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
My pleasure, Marie. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Chair and professor of media studies and production at Temple University wrote a book called From Cronkite to Colbert, The Evolution of Broadcast News. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about the program. Lots of comments here that I see on both of my screens. I'm Marty Moss. Thanks for joining us.